The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 13th of September 2022 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's programme, Ukraine's advance into previously Russian-occupied territory seems to have been even more startling than previously advertised. Uganda pays a first instalment of war reparations to the Democratic Republic of Congo. We'll take a look at how newspapers are covering this morning's European stories and...
You have to listen to the image and to look at the sound, if I may say so. You ask to movies a certain amount of things which you never ask to poetry or to paintings or to music. I wonder why.
Remembering Jean-Luc Godard, who has died at the age of 91. That's all coming up right here on The Briefing on Monocle 24. And welcome to today's edition of The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky claims that Ukraine's military have now recaptured 6,000 square kilometres from Russian occupiers in an ongoing counteroffensive. While this is a smallish fraction of the total amount of Ukrainian territory Russia still holds, it amounts, for example, to the equivalent of less than a quarter of the Crimean Peninsula, it is nevertheless immensely encouraging for Ukraine and enormously embarrassing for Russia, which is attempting to pitch this retreat as a regrouping and is now more than 6 months into what was supposed to be a 72-hour operation. Well, I'm joined with more on this by Daria Zubenko, a Ukrainian army veteran, a paramedic and an instructor at the Ukrainian Armed Forces Sniper Training School. Daria, first of all, do you get any sense that Ukraine's armed forces have surprised themselves with how much progress they've been able to make in the last week or so?
From my opinion, there was really quite surprising even for our militaries themselves, because the information about this counteroffensive was keeping quite in secret, and not everyone knew. And I don't think everyone expected that Russians will be retreating so quickly. But still, there is some... places where the fights are still very hard and they are not giving up that easy.
Do we know yet the reasons for the speed of Ukraine's advance? Is it to do with a particular weapon systems or particular tactics, or is it just the fact that Russia didn't put up as much resistance as people might have expected?
I think there are many reasons, because on the first hand, we really became much more effective with the weapons we were given, with more or less systems. And the other really important factor is just motivation of soldiers. Actually, our soldiers are motivated as never before, because they see that they can really do the quick offensive and free our cities and towns that were occupied for many months. And their information that even commanders, they don't want to stop the soldiers that want to keep on going forward.
I mean, three of the bigger towns that have been retaken are Izium, Balaklia and Kupiansk, and that is obviously encouraging to Ukrainians' military. It's obviously terrific news for the people who actually live there. But are those towns going to be militarily significant? By which I guess I'm asking, will those towns enable Ukraine's military to build on the success they've already had?
I don't know, actually. I don't have so much information about their tactical significance of these cities. But as I understand, the offensive is going to probably set free all the Kharkiv region. And it's for me, it's the most important for people who live in these towns, because winter is coming, and with help of Ukrainian authorities, with militaries and humanitarian organizations, it will be much easier for them to get ready to winter and simply to survive, because the infrastructure is ruined very much.
Are you able to quantify what kind of effect reports of these victories have had on Ukrainian morale nationally? Do people feel more optimistic than they did maybe a month or so ago?
Yeah, absolutely. They are really much more optimistic, because we have really strong enemy, and it was we all understood that it would be very hard to bring back all these territories, and if we kept on fighting for every village, for every city, as it was in May or some early month, the losses would be much harder, and also much civilians will suffer. But for now, I can tell that we're really highly motivated, but we still remember that we have to support our army, and because the fight is not over and it will keep on until all our territories are free. And this day is not that close as we want to.
I mean, military success does bring its own challenges with it. It's obviously preferable to military defeat, but it does still need to be managed. Do you get the sense that in his communications over the last few days, President Volodymyr Zelensky has been trying to manage people's expectations, that he's trying to, damp down any expectation that this war will now be over quickly?
I think that we are all quite realistic, and no matter what they say, actually, the authorities can say something just to encourage people. But for real, we understand that it can last for many months more, and maybe during the next year, because the enemy is really much stronger than we are, and all we have actually is our motivation, our people, our soldiers, and help that Western partners are given to us.
Daria Zubenko, thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing. Here is Monocle 24's Emma Searle with the day's other headlines.
Thanks, Andrew. A number of people have been crushed and injured in Nairobi as Kenyans forced their way into a stadium where William Ruto will be inaugurated as president. About 60,000 spectators arrived at the Kasarani Stadium earlier today. The swearing-in ceremony was delayed for weeks after Raila Odinga challenged the election of Ruto as Kenya's fifth president. In the United States, the Biden administration has urged railroads and unions to reach a deal to avoid a shutdown of the country's rail system, saying it would pose an unacceptable outcome to the U.S. economy. The strike could start on Friday if no agreement has been reached between 13 labor unions and the National Railway Labor Conference, representing rail companies in the U.S. And a senior Taiwanese diplomat has said that Lithuania's new representative office in Taipei has already begun operating. This comes after the Baltic country allowed Taiwan to open a de facto embassy in Vilnius. China has repeatedly denounced Lithuania for its engagement with Taiwan and has downgraded diplomatic ties. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Emma. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. Uganda has written a cheque for $65 million to the Democratic Republic of Congo, the first instalment of a total of $325 million. Uganda is on the hook for this amount by way of reparations for its involvement in the multi-country wars which consumed the DRC during the late 1990s to early 2000s. This gesture towards justice has been a while in coming. The DRC first tried to haul Uganda before the International Court of Justice in 1999, then seeking $11 billion in compensation. Well, I'm joined with more on this by Phil Clark, Professor of International Politics at SOAS, University of London. Phil, first of all, before we get to the reparations, let's talk a bit about what Uganda is having to pay reparations for. Why did Uganda get involved in Congo in the first place?
Uganda was really trying to capitalize on a really weak period in Congo in the late 90s. This was after the fall of Mobutu. Uganda saw, in particular, a huge economic opportunity. So Uganda put its national army across the border, invaded the Ituri province of northeastern Congo and basically occupied that territory for the best part of 5 years. And during that period, there was the mass murder of local Congolese citizens. About 500,000 Congolese people were displaced from that area. There was also mass pillage. Uganda was basically ripping gold and diamonds and other natural resources out and enriching them that way. So this was a really brutal period of Ugandan occupation, but also incredibly lucrative for the Ugandan government at the time.
Well, is it possible, therefore, that Uganda's actually been quite happy to pay this if it makes the whole thing go away? Because $325 million is $325 million, but it's a lot less than $11 billion.
Indeed. And that was one of the things that the Congolese government complained about in 2015. They went back to the International Court of Justice and said, look, Uganda's refusing to pay any compensation at all. So we need the court to have a look at this case again. And I think it's true that Uganda's calculation is that what they're being forced to pay in terms of reparations is minuscule in terms of what the Congolese government was demanding the first time around. The other thing that's happening here is that in the meantime, Uganda and Congo have actually fostered quite positive relations in the last year, and the Ugandan government is now benefiting from very lucrative contracts in eastern Congo. These are deals that they've done with the Congolese government. So it seems that now Uganda is also quite comfortable to pay these reparations because at the moment they're doing quite well out of these new contracts in eastern Congo. So if you add all of that up, Uganda's coming out of this looking pretty good.
Is there a delineation here in this judgment between Uganda's involvement in the first and second Congo wars, granted that the two followed each other with such rapidity that they almost seem like the same conflict? But is it possible, for example, that more cases might be pending?
I don't think there are new cases pending. I think this is probably the end of the legal road. But the question you ask is exactly the right one, that there's a bit of a sleight of hand that's gone on here, that if you look at exactly what the International Court of Justice has said, it focuses on Uganda's occupation of Ituri, particularly between 1999 and 2003. And of course, that was a very brutal period. But what it leaves out is what Uganda was doing in that same part of Congo between 1996 and 1999, which arguably was just as brutal and just as rapacious and just as lucrative for the Ugandan government. So I think that's another part of this case that Uganda will be quite pleased about, that the court hasn't scrutinized those crimes, particularly from 1996 to 1999.
Nevertheless, if you read the breakdown of the amount and how the ICJ has arrived at it, a lot of it is fairly baldly compensation for the obviously atrocious behaviour of Ugandan troops in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Is the extent of those crimes widely understood within Uganda, or do the Ugandan media not really pay all that much attention to it?
No, these crimes are definitely well documented in the Ugandan press. Uganda's media is pretty vociferous, and they were reporting, even in the late 90s and the early 2000s, almost day by day, the crimes of the Ugandan army across the border. But one of the big things that I think the ICJ case leaves out, because of course, the ICJ can only look at cases of state versus state concerns. It doesn't zero down to look at individual Ugandan military officers. And that's one of the outstanding questions here, is that there never has been any criminal accountability for the specific Ugandan commanders that were actually responsible for mass killings in Congolese villages. The International Criminal Court, which is just down the road from the ICJ in The Hague, has refused to look at anything that Uganda ever did in Congo. And there was some hope, I think, that some light would be put on that individual complicity in this ICJ case, but that really hasn't happened. So that's one of the real unanswered questions out of all of this, is will there ever be any kind of criminal accountability for those Ugandan generals and Ugandan lieutenants who were responsible for these mass crimes?
I mean, will this be the end of accounting for the Congo wars, though? Because Uganda was far from alone in African countries in wading into Congo to some extent and on various pretexts during this period.
That's also one of the big issues that the Congolese government have asked in the last 15 years is, for example, why hasn't Rwanda also been dragged in front of the ICJ? I mean, Rwanda also had invaded a similar part of Congo to what Uganda did. There were similar atrocities in the Rwandan-controlled zones. In fact, Congo tried to bring a similar case before the ICJ in relation to Rwanda, but Rwanda was more diplomatically adept than Uganda and managed to kill that case off. I think we are getting to the end of the international legal road for crimes in Congo. The International Criminal Court cases in Congo are wrapping up. This will undoubtedly be the end of the ICJ road in terms of what Uganda has done in Congo. So I don't think we're going to see any further legal developments there. But that will leave all sorts of unanswered issues. The specific role of Ugandan military and political officials named individually, that certainly has not happened. And the question of where Rwanda fits into these crimes in Congo, that's also something that has never seen its day in court.
And just finally and quickly, to bring this back to Uganda, does any of this end up sticking to President Yoweri Museveni? I mean, granted that he has now been president for the thick end of 40 years and nothing much seems to have stuck to him. But does this make a dent in him at all?
I don't think so. And I think he's been pretty adept at displacing responsibility for all of these crimes to many of his commanders in the field. And whenever he's been asked about what happened in Congo in that period, he always says that it was a few bad apples, that this was never Uganda's intention. The intention was to stabilize a restive region of Congo. But of course, you know, a few things happened by the by. So he's always managed to distance himself from that. And within Ugandan society itself, it's very hard these days to get a serious conversation going about what happened in Congo in that period. It's, even though it's been discussed quite widely, it's now seen as something in the deep, dark history of regional relations. So I think Museveni also benefits from that kind of historical amnesia within Ugandan society.
Phil Clark, thanks as always for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24.
Want to ease into your Saturdays and Sundays in top form? Then tune into Monocle Weekends, where we offer up smart discussion.
If they take the view that newspapers lie to them, that journalists make things up, then they will prefer to believe other people.
The latest from the front pages.
The Neue Zürcher Zeitung am Sonntag is reporting that Switzerland's already set aside 200 million francs.
Magazine tips, plenty of authors.
That gives me the theatre where my characters will act.
And pointers for better evenings on your terrace.
Me, I open more than one bottle because it's easier than just to focus on one bottle.
Join me, Georgina Godwin.
Me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
Me, Emma Nelson, from London.
And from Zurich, me, Tyler Brulé. Weekends live right here on Monocle 24.
You are back with The Briefing on Monocle 24. I'm Andrew Muller. We're going to take a look at the day's newspapers now with the journalist and broadcaster Juliet Linley, who is joining us from our studio in Zurich. Juliet, good afternoon, or still just about good? No, it's definitely good afternoon where you are. You're ahead of us. What are we looking at first?
Definitely good afternoon from Zurich, Andrew. I'm going to look at the New York Times first and its front page article that's entitled After the Queen, Why Stay? And Andrew, we're both from Commonwealth countries. Yours Australia, and it still has the Queen as its head of state. Mine, Trinidad and Tobago, we became a republic back in 76. So the question increasingly being debated is, will the Queen's passing mark the moment when the 14 constitutional monarchies within the 56-strong Commonwealth move to end the British monarch status as head of state? And of course, how long will most countries want to stay in the Commonwealth, and when does it actually become obsolete? So reporting from the Solomon Islands, Andrew, we have Damien Cave talking about how when the monarch was the queen, many former colonies probably found it easier to reconcile a seemingly benevolent lady with the often cruel legacy of the British Empire. But now with King Charles, many feel that the push to strip away the vestiges of colonialism will accelerate rapidly. So some are assuming that the relevance of the Commonwealth will likely remain at least in the immediate future, as it is a relatively prestigious grouping that's entirely voluntary and it connects countries with similar legal and political systems, and it promotes cultural, educational, sporting exchanges, and even trade at an unofficial level. However, we will likely see a push to move away from the monarchy and its new male head, and we can certainly expect lively debate by a younger generation of leaders, Andrew, that's far more aware of race relations and injustices and offering perhaps closure for the sins of colonialism. And that debate around republicanism is already shifting into top gear, I feel.
It's going to be interesting to see how these various countries handle the timing of this, isn't it? Because you mentioned Australia, and Anthony Albanese, Australia's Prime Minister, is an out and proud Republican who has talked about this being a goal of a second term for his government, should he get one. But in the last few days, he has been very, very much going with the "this really isn't the time" line.
Yeah, it is all about timing. I think at least until the funeral actually takes place, Andrew, we can expect a bit of reverence, if you want.
Indeed so. Well, let's take a look now at the news out of the Vatican, which is not something we do all that often.
Exactly. And so the Pope is heading to Kazakhstan today. And while that might not strike you as being particularly relevant news-wise, well, it's actually interesting to note that there's a strong link to the Russian offensive in Ukraine with the story. So Francis is coming to the former Soviet Republic for a meeting of leaders of world religions, but one person glaringly absent is Russian Orthodox Patriarch Kirill. He's been very vocally supporting the war against Ukraine. Many Vatican observers had been speculating that the two leaders would finally have a chance to meet on the margins of the Congress, which would have been notable and could have perhaps helped to clarify positions, because the Pope is obviously consistently and very publicly pressing for peace. But Kirill steadfastly refuses to speak out against Russian President Putin, and he calls it a special military operation. So his silence has been very loud in the anti-war narrative, and that meeting is not happening now. However, another underlying theme during these next 2 days will no doubt be the Vatican's relationship with Beijing, as Chinese President Xi Jinping is slated to visit Kazakhstan at the same time as Francis, not within the realms of that Congress, but he's on his way to Uzbekistan, where he's meeting Putin. So Jinping's visit takes place as the Vatican and China are negotiating the renewal of a highly controversial agreement on the appointment of bishops, which is opposed by many who think the Vatican shouldn't have dealings with a country which has long clamped down on religious freedom and is known for religious persecution. So, Andrew, speculation is rife about whether the pontiff might potentially meet the Chinese president when their visits coincide. So far, no official word on that front.
Well, let's look finally at news from Switzerland, and a lovely illustration of how, at a moment like this, everybody is desperate to shoehorn a local angle into their coverage.
The Alpine nation is definitely shoehorning itself. So this is a piece from Swiss Info, and it's called Switzerland at the House of Windsor. And it's looking at how the British royals have always maintained a close relationship with China. So on the one hand, with Switzerland. On the one hand, ultra-democratic Switzerland couldn't be further apart from the inherited privilege of the Windsors. But food, art and sports helped to close that gap, and a little bit of soft politics too. So who catered Prince William and Kate's wedding banquet, Prince Philip's 70th birthday celebrations, and the Queen's golden wedding anniversary? Well, the Alpine nation's Anton Mosimann, born in Nidau in Canton Bern, and his culinary exploits have even earned him an OBE. Also at an artistic level, Queen Victoria's famed for having executed many a fetching watercolour in the mountains around Lucerne as she was mourning her husband Albert back in the 1860s. And finally, from a sporting perspective, it's no secret that King Charles has been coming to ski in Clusters for more than 4 decades, while his brother, Prince Andrew, was known to be a fan of Verbier. And on the soft politics front, while historians say the Queen's only official visit to Switzerland in 1980 was timed to boost the image of the UK during the Falkland crisis, as it found itself increasingly isolated and was struggling with a bit of economic problems. And apparently, yes, the Swiss were indeed very taken by the monarch during her tour de Suisse.
Juliette Linley in our Zurich newsroom, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. And finally, on today's show, the film world is mourning Jean-Luc Godard, who has died at the age of 91. And with more on Godard's life and legacy, I'm joined now by the film critic Karen Krasanovich. Karen, we will get to the scale of his influence, who he influenced and how, but I wanted to talk a bit first about why he was influential. What was it about his films that inspired so many other directors?
Well, he was one of the key figures of the French New Wave style, and it's something that we take for granted now. Like when we see a montage, we think, oh, big deal. Well, at one point, that was a really new thing. So he influenced the style of, let's say, Mean Streets, Scorsese's 1973 opus, or Bonnie and Clyde with his Arthur Penn's from 1967. It was all about sort of breaking the traditional way film was made or shot. Handheld cameras, non-professional actors, naturalistic dialogue, natural setting. You'd say a dogma sort of its era.
I mean, he did start out as a film critic and made that jump from, I forget which round the gamekeeper and the poacher are in this synonym, but you know what I'm saying. When he started making films, did he approach it with a particular philosophy that he had burnished or expounded while he was merely writing about films?
I think he was actually a great proponent of the Hollywood system and liked people like Otto Preminger, which in the 50s and 60s really wasn't very fashionable to do. He had his own ideas about things, and he's got some great quotes. For example, he said, "He who jumps into the void owes no explanation to those who stand and watch." I love that. But he's the most
You really
famous.
Need a French accent to get away with that one, don't you?
I'm not even going to try. one of his most famous aphorisms is, "Cinema is truth at 24 frames a second." Now, if that's not a journalist, I don't know what is.
Well, indeed so. But do we see here one of those illustrations of a not entirely reliable maxim, but a usually reliable maxim that if you're going to set yourself up as an iconoclast, you do actually have to know your subject beforehand?
No, yes, and he did. You have to know the rules to break them. And I think he knew, taking a treatment, let's say, for Breathless, which is my favorite. He took a treatment that Truffaut had written that decided he wasn't going to use, and turned it into this really breakthrough film in 1960, which said made Gene Seberg a star and also put Jean-Paul Belmondo on the map. But it's a film that if you were watching anything before that film, it was nothing like what you'd seen. And so you knew that you can't just haplessly look into making a film like this. You have to know what you're doing and then decide to do something radically not that.
You mentioned Breathless as your favorite. We will come shortly to the reasons for that, but first of all, let's hear some of it.
C'est samedi dimanche à Monte Carlo, fallait que je voie un type. Lundi, j'ai essayé de t'appeler de Marseille.
Lundi et dimanche, t'es pas à Paris.
New York Herald Tribune!
Je t'en prends un.
C'est gentil.
A clip there from Breathless. So why would you personally, Karen, identify that one as your favorite?
Well, her French accent's terrible as well as mine. it's the most iconic one, and it's the one that we've seen the most, and you can still buy her T-shirt. I mean, they're actually selling those now. It's just really sticks in the mind, and when you watch it, you think, oh, I've seen this before, but it was the first of its kind. It was the first of this sort of existential kind of criminal with his girlfriend, and that sounds like such a cliche to us now, but it was really new and fresh then. It also meant that new wave cinema sprang up all over the globe, from Brazil to Czechoslovakia to Japan. Generations of directors like De Palma and Tarantino followed him. So he was a really, really important figure. And don't forget, he also won a 2010 honorary Oscar, which was inscribed for passion, for confrontation, for a new kind of cinema. And of course, he didn't turn up to collect it.
Breathless, of course, being an exemplar of another one of his grandiloquent quotes, that maxim that all you really need is a girl and a gun. I suspect it was rather more complicated than that. But just finally, and I know that there's probably a very long answer to this question, we're looking for one more in the realm of about 25 seconds. Where do we mostly now see his influence? What do we see on a screen now that we basically owe to him?
Anything that doesn't look like it's got continuity, anything that looks natural, looks sort of juddery, anything that you think, well, I could do this myself, but this is so much better. anything that's also like a long take that seems very natural and you feel like you're in the movie, that's what Godard gave us.
Karen Krzanovich, thank you for joining us. That is all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Carlotta Ribello. Our researcher was Tamsin Howard, and our studio manager today was Emily Sands. The Briefing returns tomorrow at the same time. I'll be back with The Daily at 1800 London later today. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.